You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Good morning, Pittsburgh diners and travelers, and good afternoon to our overseas listeners, and good morning to Peter.
Good morning, good morning. Don't forget the guys down under, it's already Monday.
Right, and we have our first guest on the line, Jeremy Black, who's going to be talking to us about Asahi, and he's the global brand manager for Sambosan, which is, and is the first. Is it the only exporter of this, the super berry?
We're not the only, but we were the first.
Okay. Back up. You were not on the original trip. That was your brother and somebody else, right?
It was actually, yeah, my brother and his best friend, and they were down there, and they had the opportunity to experience acai. They ate a bowl of it with local surfers, and they were blown away by the taste and the nutrition and the way it made them feel. And when it came time to leave Brazil a few weeks later, they'd been eating it every day, and they were like, wow, we got to get this stuff back. Even if it's just for ourselves, we got to find a way to bring it back.
Could you describe what it is?
Acai is a purple berry that grows on a palm tree that grows along the Amazon rainforest river. So you've got all these amazing purple berries growing along the Amazon. And, you know, the locals eat it as a dietary staple with all kinds of things. But in the mid-90s, athletes in Brazil started using it to make smoothies, specifically kind of a smoothie in a bowl really thick with granola. And that's what got really popular with the youth culture in Brazil. Took it from being an Amazon thing to kind of the way Starbucks blew up here in the U.S. Now everywhere you go in Brazil, whether it's a gym or a juice bar or a local cafe, acai is very popular now.
Now, be more specific about down there, Jeffrey. Brazil is a big country.
Yeah, well, if you were down there, which is, you know, Rio de Janeiro, São Paulo, which is in the middle on the coast, you would have not seen acai before the mid-90s. But mid-90s is when it started showing up at all the juice bars along the beach, and there's tens of thousands of juice bars all over Brazil. A lot of them line the beaches, and, you know, every corner has a juice bar.
So it's a special kind of palm, and it's like a date palm is a kind of palm tree, and acai palm is a different kind of palm?
Yeah, it is a different kind of palm tree, very slender. It's a clumping palm, so you see multiple stalks coming out of the same root system. And it's the same tree that you see a lot of heart of palm actually coming from.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and it grows along the Amazon River and its tributaries?
Yeah, it grows along the Amazon and in the floodplains, and it's one of the most abundant trees in the Amazon floodplain. So you've got these trees that are being basically fed by the Amazon rain, Amazon River.
And you said that the people who discovered it, they discovered that Brazilians had been eating it traditionally for years, so they thought it was safe. I mean, they weren't worried about eating it.
No, it's been a dietary staple of the people up in the Amazon for thousands and thousands of years.
Okay. You know, what I always want to ask is, how much of this do you have to eat in order to feel some kind of physical effect? It's a super berry, so you're supposed to feel energetic and alert and strong.
You know, that all depends on your specific metabolism. I personally like to consume, you know, 3 to 4 to 5 ounces of acai fruit a day. But we make, for example, we have a dried powder that comes in a capsule form, which is only about a gram of fruit pulp concentrated as a dried powder. And I've had, you know, my grandfather calls me up and says, hey, I've been taking those, you know, a couple grams of those capsules a day, and I feel more energy from all the antioxidants and things like that. So, you know, he's like, I don't take a nap in the afternoon anymore just because
wow.
I've been taking these pills. And I was kind of blown away by that. But, you know, when you think about it, a lot of people are not getting a lot of nutrition in a lot of food they eat. When you eat something that's got a lot of antioxidants, healthy fats, fiber, it can go a long way, even a small amount.
Well, hold on just a second here. Now, this is not a controlled supplement. I mean, this is a dietary supplement, but it's not like the stuff that Mark McGuire was taking so he could hit 70 home runs. I mean, what side of the dividing line is it on here?
This is actually an organic fruit. So it's 100% natural. It's basically, you know, you find antioxidants in a lot of things like oranges, grapes, things like that. Acai is a purple berry, very high in antioxidants, more than red wine, more than blueberries, pomegranate. But it also, in addition to the antioxidants, is very rich in omega fats, some of the same fats that you find in olive oil, avocados, things like that. So you've got kind of a 1-2 punch of antioxidants and healthy fats. And that's, you know, that's the building blocks of giving you energy.
Now, you talked about the Brazilians consuming it mixed in with cereal or muesli or something like that, but you've changed the form factor to make it much easier to absorb, I guess.
Well, we serve it in a variety. We sell it and distribute it and serve it in a variety of ways. We sell the fruit pulp, which you can actually make those same bowls that they eat down in Rio, which is basically a kind of like a smoothie in a bowl with granola. We bottle it like a bottled smoothie, and we sell it as a powder form, and you can do anything with the powder. Kind of like if you had a blueberry powder, you can bake muffins, you can stir it in like a protein powder into any juice, smoothie, milk, anything like that. So there's a wide variety of ways you can consume it.
Okay, and we got these wild colored smoothie drinks, I guess, is the way that we absorbed it when you sent it to us.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the simplest way we found to help the American public experience it was put it in a bottle so they could just crack the cap open and drink it down. And a lot of people are drinking smoothies these days, so we made an organic antioxidant smoothie with acai as the base.
How hard is it to get a company started out of the Amazon?
It was immense. It was way harder than we could have ever dreamed of. We thought, hey, you know, we'll just, you know, we'll buy a container of this fruit pulp, we'll bring it up, we'll sell it to juice bars. That part seemed easy, but, you know, dealing with getting a supply chain out of the Amazon, making sure that all the food safety issues were addressed properly, all that, it was pretty amazing that we survived the first couple years of this, actually.
Now, this is supposed to benefit local farmers in the Amazon.
Yeah, it's an amazing opportunity that we've had because the propagation of acai since the mid-90s when it went from being a, you know, a regional thing to being very popular in Brazil and now how it's becoming more popular all over the globe, it's giving a lot more opportunity to harvest these berries in the Amazon. And where 15 years ago, if you were farming in the Amazon, were living there, you know, you didn't know how you were going to get paid or earn a wage. Sometimes people would come to you and say, hey, clear down all these trees and plant soy or raise cattle and we'll pay you. Now we're able to go to these people and say, hey, leave everything as it is. Manage the acai trees that are growing wild everywhere. Get the fruit from those and we'll pay you a fair trade wage, a premium, and we'll guarantee your crop. So now these guys have a reason to actually protect the forest, and we refer to that as market-driven conservation.
Oh, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, because, this is a huge rainforest that's been, as you suggested, has been logged and burned down and turned to other uses and not necessarily very efficiently, and it would be nice if it stayed the way it was.
Yeah, there's amazing things in the rainforest. There just needs to be a system put together for people to have a reason to protect it. And at the end of the day, it all comes down to the money that needs to be paid to the people that own or live on that land because they need to live, they need to survive. And if somebody's putting money in their hand to cut down trees and they don't have any other options, that's what they're going to do. They're not going to go innovate and try and create an export market for something that's in the rainforest. That's it.
You know, I often wonder how much is down there that has to be discovered. I mean, aren't there lots of medical research teams trying to find the secrets of, you know, natural substances in the Amazon?
There is a lot of good things going on as far as looking for things in the Amazon. I know a lot of pharmaceutical companies are finding all kinds of amazing things. And I think this trend that we're seeing towards more natural and organic products is going to help increase that. So we're pretty excited about having the opportunity to use acai as a role model, the way that the way that it's being harvested and brought to market, to use that role model for other products coming down the line. Because the bad thing is people could go and cut down a bunch of trees and plant a ton of acai, and that's not what we want to see happen. If the biodiversity is left intact, you can still manage it, and you can get, at the end of the day, what you're looking for, which is a lot of the product, but you can also help protect the rainforest.
Now, you import this in the berry form and then process it here. Is that the way it works, Jeffrey?
Jeremy. The berries actually are very perishable. Once they're picked from the tree, they start degrading, and you're going to see in about 24 hours, you're going to lose a lot of the purple pigments, and it starts to go bad. So it actually has to be processed within 24 hours of the time it's picked from the tree.
Wow.
We take the berries, and we scrape the pulp off the seeds, and then we take the frozen pulp in either a frozen drum or some kind of finished product form, and we send that here to the U.S. to make the smoothies that you guys have seen that we sell in most grocery stores. We actually take that drum of frozen fruit pulp, mix it with other things like banana puree and apple juice, things like that, to make the smoothie, and we bottle that here in the United States.
Sure. So the people are actually doing the removal of the pulp from the seeds. That's the people who grow it?
No, those are the people that are harvesting the berries. The people that process it are actually our employees. We have an industrial
facility
down there.
Okay, super.
Is there a website?
Yes, our website is sambazon.com, spelled sambazon.com. If you search Google, you can write in acai, A-C-A-I, and we're the top on Google.
How big a company is it?
We now have, in the U.S., about 50 employees. We're selling our stuff in most major grocery stores across the country now. We've got about 100 employees in Brazil running that factory. And the rough numbers are there's in the neighborhood of 3,000-4,000 people in the rainforest harvesting these berries for us.
And what's next? Are you looking for other crops like this, or...?
Well, we think we've got our hands full getting acai to the masses right now. It'll be a few more years of really focusing on acai, but there are other fruits that that we do sell, and we're going to be focusing on in the future, I believe.
What kind? Do you have any hints?
Well, one of the ones that we also sell is called acerola, and you've probably seen it in vitamin C pills. But it's an amazing citrus fruit that has 10 times the vitamin C of orange juice.
Right. We had somebody on here with black currants. Now, that's supposed to be real high up there, too.
Black currant is also high in antioxidants.
Yeah.
It's a great tasting fruit.
So you've got pomegranate, you've got black currant. Anything else?
You know, there's some other ones out there that are pretty exotic, but we really just sell those to chefs. There's a fruit called coupoisu. But there's a ton of amazing fruits in the Amazon.
What is that noise?
Sounds like somebody's cell phone.
I don't know. But at any rate, well, we're going to have to take a break. So I want to thank you, Jeremy, for explaining all this to us. We now are much smarter about this.
And don't forget, if you don't want to take a nap in the afternoon, listeners, you got to get some acai from Sambazon.
Right. Jeremy, thank you again.
Thank you.
We'll go to a break.
Bye-bye.
What is it about food that evokes such warmth and excitement this time of year? Whether it's a simple homemade cookie or an elaborate turkey dinner, the warmth of food comes from sharing it. Sharing Food is at the heart of Table magazine. Table is the first and only publication for Pittsburgh and southwestern Pennsylvania that celebrates food for our region. Read about local farms, fresh produce, new recipes, old recipes, great chefs, and inspiring regional road trips with tasty destinations. The holiday issue of Table is available online now, and subscriptions are the perfect gift. At www.tablemagazine.com, you can order Table for One for $14.95, Table for Two for $24.95, or make it a party with Table for Four for only $39.95. That's four subscriptions for only $10 each for the whole year. Talk about a gift of food that won't go bad. So if you're craving the perfect way to feed the imagination of friends or family who are ready to devour all the best our region has to offer, subscribe today at www.tablemagazine.com.
Mommy, for my birthday, I want a princess party.
Give your little girl a party she'll remember forever from Sweet Pea Parties.
Mommy, this is wonderful.
Sweet Pea Parties will send out beautiful handmade invitations and then bring decorations, princess gowns to dress up in, fabulous favor bags, real linen and china, fun games, even a real princess to transform your home into your child's fantasy wonderland.
Do they do parties for boys, too?
You bet they do. Safari adventures, pirates and dinosaur themes for the boys, princess, diva, and spa parties for the girls.
Yay!
Woohoo! Our hostesses make your party effort-free. They'll even send out thank you notes featuring each child's personal photo from the party. See for yourself at www.sweet-p-parties.com or call them 412-805-9623. Sweet Pea Parties, 412-805-9623.
Mommy, this was the best party ever.
Influenza is a serious disease.
Are you talking to me?
If you have asthma, diabetes, or other chronic medical conditions, yes.
Are you talking to me?
If you're 50 or older, yes. If your child is between 6 and 23 months, yes.
Are you talking to me?
If you live or work with those at high risk, yes. Influenza will kill as many as 36,000 people this year. It's that serious. Prevent influenza. Get immunized. A message from the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Remember to check out our website, onthemenuradio.com, to follow all our shows, get additional dish, and email us at any time. Just click on the spot that tells you you could do it on the website. We have also a guest. Our next guest is Mitchell Davis, who has a book called The Kitchen Sense.
It's called Kitchen Sense. And I wanted to start Mitchell off by talking to him about the dilemma that he talks about on page little xi. You talk about non-cooks frustrated with their attempts in the kitchen. He knows some people don't cook because they associate it with the resentment they felt about their mothers. And no, people stop cooking because of the children. Food has become something to fear. But here's the fascinating part. Further complicating a relationship with food has been the drastic change in the food scene. New interest and enthusiasm for cooking shows and other food media, chefs and restaurants have been resulted in more people who know a lot more about food and how it's made. But fewer people are actually cooking. Which is it's the wildest paradox. It's reflected in our house, Mitchell, by the piles and piles and piles of cookbooks that we collect, and more of them seem to be coming out all the time, and yet people are cooking less.
Exactly, and to be honest, I haven't really wrapped my head around it. You know, there are beautiful magazines about food filled with full of tons of recipes. We have beautiful grocery stores, and then when you look at the statistics, you know, takeout is on the rise. All the sort of almost prepared foods are on the rise. Restaurant eating out is on the rise. So part of what I think the dilemma is that there's a lot of people who know a whole lot more about food, but a whole lot less, perhaps, about how to actually prepare it. And I mean the knowledge not just in your brain, but in your hands and in the experience that you get from being in the kitchen, which is different from learning about food any other way.
You are actually, I know you through the James Beard Foundation, is how I know you. And I never had a handle on what you exactly do. You're in charge of publications for them?
My role has changed a little bit in the last while, over the last couple of years. We're in charge of all the communications for the organization, which includes some publications and some PR and also some programming and conferences and educational things that we consider part of the communication of our mission, which is to celebrate, preserve, and nurture America's culinary diversity and heritage.
Could you do that one again? I'm just teasing. Now, the other thing about it is you're doing something that I'm just fascinated with. You are getting a degree in culinary history, aren't you?
Sort of culinary history.
Tell me about it.
What we call it. There's a Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University here in the city. And I'm doing my PhD, actually, and my topic of my dissertation is restaurant reviewing and the way that affects our taste for food.
Oh, really? I mean, I did that for, 14 years or something, restaurant criticism, restaurant reviewing. Tell me what the answer is. How does it
affect? I don't quite have the answer yet, but I think that America is a unique case study in the world of restaurants and food and food writing because we don't all have an intimate relationship with some sort of national cuisine or a culinary tradition per se. We've got lots of little ones, but there isn't really an overarching national cuisine or history of food here. And I think that what that does is it gives people who write about food, especially restaurant critics, a lot of power to affect taste, because that's where we learn about things. I mean, it's a little bit like I was saying earlier, that dilemma. We learn here in America, we learn about food from reading about it, from watching television about it, from talking about it, but not so much from actually doing it or having our own opinions before we start. And so I think that gives restaurant critics a very strong, powerful role here. And I hope to show in my work how that happens.
We interviewed Gail Green about her. Of course, she equates the evolution of the sensuous and cuisine and, you know, that kind of reporting on it with the sexual revolution.
Anyway, this is a fascinating book. I mean, this is a book of recipes, and let's come back to that one in just a second. But it's a book that's got some really interesting stuff in it too. I'm on page 83. What exactly the Earl of Sandwich is supposed to have invented in the 18th century? I'm not quite sure. Since just about every culture is part of some form of sandwich.
Here I am. I study food in academia, but I think that one of our problems is people take food too seriously, you know? And it is, in fact, fun and wonderful and delicious and yummy and all the sort of visceral things that food can be, in addition to being an intellectual pursuit. And sometimes I think we lose sight of that.
Now, let me...
people in my field.
Let me try to catch you out on a little bit of history and geography here. What piece of land used to be called the Sandwich Islands? It's named after the same gentleman that you introduced us to. Ooh,
wow.
This is a tough one.
The Earl of I don't know. geography is really not my beat.
That's not my beat either.
Hawaii was originally called the Sandwich Islands.
Isn't that funny?
So the Earl must have been somehow involved in discovering them. And,
sure.
And somewhere along the way, I guess he packed a lunch.
Well, I wonder. Maybe that's why he discovered the sandwich. That's a long way from England.
he might have needed a few more sandwiches to get along the way. But right. Let's talk a bit about how the book is organized, because
talk a bit about who it's for. I think that what I was understanding, and especially all the wonderful accolades of the back, is that it was intended for the home cook. Is that
true? Well, I can answer both of those things. I think it is intended for the home cook, and I think that in some ways, let me say that most cookbooks are intended for the home cook, but they're not all written for the home
cook.
Exactly. And there's a big popular trend of books by professional chefs, and I think that's wonderful, and their books are beautiful, and their knowledge of food is impressive. But I think that's part of the intimidation factor, too, because people cooking at home are just not cooking restaurant food. And, you know, I'm not a professional chef, although I've worked in kitchens. It's really what I do is I cook at home, and I cook for my friends, and I cook for my family, and I think that distinguishes it. And so, to your point about how it's organized, I kind of feel like most cookbooks are organized in a way that we don't really eat anymore. You know, the appetizers, soups, entrees, that kind of thing. And we tried to think of a different way to organize a book that reflected more, I think, of how people consider a meal today. You know, there was a time when a special dinner was five courses at home, and you were really entertaining. And in the end, we couldn't really think of another useful way, since we're all prepared to think of it. So, I mean, this book is pretty standard, except for a few chapters. There's one on sandwiches and pizza, which isn't quite a sandwich, but it also isn't quite anything else. And a book on, you know, hors d'oeuvres and party foods, finger foods, I like to call them. Pretty standard stuff, but hopefully, my idea wasn't that you would pick something from each chapter to create a meal, but you'd flip through and find things that you thought might be delicious, and you try to cook them, and then come up with something that you'd like to eat.
What are your favorite recipes in here?
Oh, goodness. Well, there's a combination of different types of recipes in here. There are some that are just family recipes that are sort of my personal comfort food, things like the baked macaroni
mac
and cheese with tomatoes, which my family always called the cheese thing, and it's just how it was always known in our house.
The cheese thing.
Sorry?
It was called the cheese thing.
Yeah, well, that's what we called it. And here I can find the page reference for you while I chat. There's a great recipe. I happen to be a real fan of baked beans made at home, the kind that you put in the oven at night and wake up in the morning
and
they're done and delicious.
I remember those.
And And I've got a couple of recipes for those in here that I really like.
Yeah, I had the book marked at orange soy sauce salmon. I don't know why.
Yeah, you like that. I don't know why.
Well, we never made it, but I was looking for a new salmon recipe because I was getting bored with salmon recipes.
Uh-huh. And, well, that one couldn't be easier, and I think it's really quite yummy to use that.
Well, you know, we're getting spoiled because we got so much product from everybody, you know. But, you know, where Peter now has a whole entire palette to use, like an artist. Well, tonight are we going to use the Aragon oil, and are we going to use the pistachio oil?
I got hollered at last night for flash frying the tilapia in argan oil, and Anne said that oil's for finishing.
I
said,
"Yeah, I mean it's a finishing oil."
But it tasted fabulous.
You didn't?
Oh, good.
Oh, geez, you could have gotten the flavor by finishing it with that. The oil.
Well,
this is a family feud here. We're not going to go on with that, Mitchell.
And so, you seem to have a simple ingredient list. This is one that seems to be, this appeals to me a lot. I think so many of the books that we get, although they say they're for the home cook and they say that any well-stocked larder will have all of these things, it turns out that they really don't.
No, of course. And I think there's another intimidation factor in many cookbooks when you have to mail order your ingredients before you can start cooking. I think that's a lot of people I know off. But at the same, on the same account, I don't believe in dumbing down recipes. Like I think easy cooking isn't sort of stupid cooking. It's just basic or simple in a way, not because it has fewer ingredients necessarily, but just because what you need to do isn't complicated. I would have mild arguments with my editor just because I wanted to classify something as very simple if it took 5 hours to cook, and really it just took 5 minutes to put everything in a pot. Or with the baked beans, they're a perfect example. It takes 10 minutes to put all the ingredients in one pot, and then it takes 8 hours to cook. That doesn't make it any more complicated because you're not fanning the fire.
Right.
You know, it's just in a cool oven overnight. You're literally sleeping while they bake. So I think that I'm trying to recontextualize what people think is hard when it comes to cooking and off-putting. And, the length of an ingredients list, I mean, if there are things, I have a lot of little jars of spices in my cupboard, but just because you need a few of them doesn't make anything more complicated than if it just has salt and pepper, I think.
Uh-huh.
If they're not, as you said, sort of exotic, esoteric. Now I have to go try to fry something in argan oil, I think.
Oh, please. Now, how is this book? Our son had Mark Bittman's book, How to Cook Everything.
Sure.
And Peter fell in love with that one, our son, before he moved away. How is this different from that? You don't intend to be encyclopedic, do you?
No, which is a function really of the economics of publishing in some ways. And Mark Bittman, whose book is great and is a big supporter of mine, he actually gave me a quote for the back.
I have that.
We used to joke that we were calling this How to Cook Everything Else. but that was just a working title amongst my editor. No, I mean, this is not intended to be everything. My approach when I did the recipe list, which is in some ways random, was to reflect how we eat foods from all over the world, even if we just do takeout or you go to a Whole Foods and they have Chinese sorts of things and Thai sorts of things and Mexican sorts of things. I'm not saying things because they're not authentic. And I wanted to create a book that you could go to if you had an ingredient that you wanted to use and find something good to make with it, or if you had a craving and you wanted to satisfy that craving. And so you could come at it from both sides. So it's not everything, certainly, but it's a lot of things, and hopefully with enough information for you to make them successfully.
You know, the Eric Repair, I really cannot wait to have Mitchell's book on my shelf. Why? Because Mitchell can cook. And extremely well. Recipes written by a great home cook make a difference. Mitchell understands your challenges probably better than a professional chef who has all the equipment of a professional kitchen. By the way, try the simple seafood sausage. It's the best I've ever had. Now, that's something coming from Eric, right?
It is, and believe me, I was nervous to serve it to him when I did, and he actually ended up putting it on his menu for a short period of time. And
it's
a seafood sausage, and I hesitate to say that because it sounds more complicated. Just sausage scares people that they have to do something, but it couldn't be any easier, and it's so delicious. I remember I once made it for my sister who watched me cook it, and it said to her aloud, "Even I could make that."
So could you hold on a bit? Well, we take a break. I'm having the director is motioning. Ed, we'll take a break now.
Furnace working okay? How's your heating bills? You know, no kidding, an old or inefficient furnace can really add to the cost of keeping your home warm. If you want to keep costs down, get your furnace looked at, and I recommend Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning for that. The technicians at Bolster DeHart have been performing routine maintenance and installing high-efficiency heating and air conditioning systems in Pittsburgh since 1977. They're EPA-certified professionals who are continually factory-trained in all the latest installation and service techniques. They offer free estimates and don't even charge extra for Saturday service. They're a quality dealer you can trust. Stay warm this winter at the lowest possible cost. Call Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning at 412-367-3900. Maintenance or installation, Bolster DeHart Heating and Air Conditioning, 412-367-3900.
T1 Internet access wasn't affordable to many companies as little as 2 years ago. Service providers were charging in the thousands of dollars, keeping the benefits of a T1 connection out of most companies' reach. ASP Station is now offering the faster and more reliable T1 service at a price significantly less than 2 years ago. The speed of a T1 for both sending and receiving data is simply amazing and will change the way your business runs indefinitely. You'll wonder how you ever lived without it. Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Call ASP Station now for details. 412-661-6001. That's 412-661-6001. Log on aspstation.net for more information. ASP Station, it's the way to go fast.
Hi, everyone. This is Tom Rita, the networking guy and host of Pittsburgh's most unique business show, Business in the Fast Lane. We're on every Saturday morning from 12 noon to 1 p.m. right here on The Edge, 1550 a.m. For the past 24 months, we've been bringing the best and the brightest into our studios to offer you ideas, advice, and real-world examples to help you grow your business. So save those honeydews for the afternoon and join me, Tom Rita, every Saturday morning from 12 to 1 on The Edge for Business in the Fast Lane, Pittsburgh's best kept secret.
You are listening to The Edge, AM 1550, WURP, Braddock, Pittsburgh.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Welcome also. We're continuing our discussion with Mitchell Davis and his book Kitchen Sense. And we have a new guest, Nick Malgieri, who has been on our show before. We're talking about his book, his latest book, Perfect Light Desserts, which I think everybody is going to need after all the holidays. Everything on all under 300 calories per generous serving. And it turns out that Nick and Mitchell are neighbors and good buds. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
And thanks, Mitchell, for staying around. How about if Nick describes what prompted this book?
Well, actually, the book was prompted by my co-author, David Joachim, because David had previously been an editor at Rodale, the healthy press. He had asked me to do this book, I would say, about 15 years ago. And, you know, in the intervening time, he was no longer working there. And about, I guess it was about 4 or 5 years ago, I was looking around for some things to do. So I saw David at a convention, and I said, well, you know, that book that you had wanted me to do all that time ago, maybe we should do it together. So it was really great because it was a good combination. I did the recipes, and David kept screaming at me that everything had too much sugar and fat and nuts in it.
Anyway,
it was quite an experience writing those recipes, though, I have to say, with one hand on the keyboard and the other one on the calculator. Going to those websites that tell you how many calories are in a tablespoon of sour cream.
Yes, those are terrible. What about these people? Did you read was it in New York Magazine, people who are eating the minimum number of calories to stay alive? What are they called?
Yes, I did hear about that, right.
But they have dinner parties where there's somebody there with a computer actually getting all the calories
down. That sounds
down.
Like an that's eating disorder to me.
Well, you know, it's
just
not,
none
though.
None of us is invited to one of those parties.
Well, that's okay, you know.
But, you know, it's not, because the theory is, they stop short of any kind of eating disorder because, I mean, their main thing is to just skim the edge of it, because the fewer calories you eat, supposedly the longer you're supposed to live.
Uh-huh.
So they don't want to die, they want to live.
I know. Have you ever gotten that wonderful email where there's a picture of a very, very old man kind of stooped over and very thin and looks like he's at death's door, sitting on the examining table, and the doctor is sitting on a chair in front of him, and he's saying to the doctor, "So this is why I dieted all my life and got all that exercise, so that I could feel awful at 92. But, you know, anyway, I want to address something that you said when you introduced me, because you mentioned that Perfect Light desserts would be great for after the holidays.
Right.
With all the overindulging, but actually, you know what? It's great for during the holidays, because every recipe in the book is a normal dessert recipe. They are not recipes from which anything has been removed or deleted or really particularly changed in order to make it into a light dessert. They are things that are intrinsically light desserts.
But how did you think them up? I mean, how did you... You don't usually focus on these light desserts, do you?
Well, no, except for the fact that, again, I have a lot of recipes from, you know, years and years of teaching and writing where the desserts themselves are intrinsically light, like the ones that are in the book.
Mm-hmm. I keep drawn to this one, grapefruit and Campari sherbet.
Yeah, which is a great recipe. And, you know, again, a recipe that has not had anything taken away from it. In order to be a light dessert, it just is very light.
Hmm. Wow. What's your favorite? Does it feel, Mitch, jump in when you want to.
Well, I'm just getting hungry thinking about that sorbet. So.
Yeah, well, you know what? The other thing that I really love there's a whole chapter of ices and frozen desserts. And another thing very much like the grapefruit and Campari sherbet, I never say sorbet unless I'm speaking French, is the fact that there's a whole section of different kinds of Italian gelati. And again, it's exactly
slower
the same
fat.
Thing. Mm. The gelati are not things which need to have anything taken away from them in order to be light desserts. They just are naturally light.
Hmm. What about fudgy brownies? I mean,
fudgy brownies are very much like, I'll tell you what the texture of the fudgy brownies is like, because they weigh in at very, I've got my book open here and I've got to check the calorie count on that. They are almost completely fat free. Well, but again, a recipe for a fat-free brownie, not one obvious. 137 calories each, that's not bad. You could eat three.
Now, do you have recipes like that in your book, Mitchell? Or are yours real brownies?
I didn't do the calorie counts on my recipes, but Nick's approach of finding recipes that exist that are intrinsically light is what I was saying earlier about how important it is not to dumb things down to make them seem simple, but to find simple recipes that are complete and intrinsically easy and just delicious. I think it's a very similar approach, because the end result is that you are eating real food, light or easy or whatever.
Exactly. I went to the farmer's market during the summer, and I bought some corn, and I said, you know, I really feel like making some corn chowder. I love soup 12 months a year. And so I got home, and I looked in a few cookbooks, and I was amazed by the fact that most of the recipes that I found for corn chowder had over 2 cups of cream in them.
Yeah.
There was a recipe that served 4 to 6 people that had a quart of cream in it.
Oh, gee.
Right.
And then there was another one, actually, it happened to be that very same month, in a national magazine, whose name I won't mention, which called for using half a pound of bacon for the corn chowder that was going to serve six people. So, you know, I went into the kitchen and I had some bacon, I had some potatoes, I certainly had this fabulously fresh corn. So I said, okay, I think I'm going to use a quarter of a cup of diced bacon, and I waited, and it was about an ounce. But I didn't hold back on anything, but I didn't want a lot of bacon in it, because the bacon should only be there to be a subtle flavor, because it's corn chowder, not bacon chowder.
Right. Yeah, otherwise it would be. Otherwise, yeah, you're perfectly right. Otherwise it would be bacon chowder.
Yeah, and then after it was completely cooked, it had all the seasonings in it, and you know, and the corn and the potatoes, and I went through the baloney of milking the ears with the back of the knife and everything else. I tasted it. And I think I put in, there were four, it was going to make four servings. I had a little less than 2 quarts of soup. And I tasted it and I said, okay, let me throw in some cream. And I measured a third of a cup of cream and I poured it in and I stirred it around and I tasted it. It tasted very creamy.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, so I just avoided putting in the other, you know, 1 2/3 cups of cream. I said, if I had done that, I think the soup probably would have tasted like, you know, some kind of weird melted ice cream or something.
Right. Yeah, well, we just got back from Savannah and we ate at a place that was all boarding house Southern food. I mean, it was really astounding. I never seen
like
so much
fun.
Food in my life. But anyway, there were 25 dishes already on the table when we sat down, including fried chicken, of course. Nick, I don't know if I've ever asked you, how did you get to where you are with your specialties? You teach baking, don't you, at the
Institute of Culinary Education.
Yeah,
it used to be called
the French
New York Cooking School. Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say this, I don't know that I've ever really told anybody about this publicly, but as a little boy, I sat in front of the TV a lot in the early days of television when Josephine McCarthy, James Beard, and Dione Lucas were on every day, and I just loved that. I loved watching them. I loved the idea of kind of cooking in public like that and explaining what you were doing. And that coupled with the fact that I grew up in a home where, you know, somebody was cooking or baking something 18 hours a day. my maternal grandmother lived with us, and she loved to cook and bake. Mm-hmm. And so I was around it all the time. It seemed like the most natural thing in the world to me. And that was coupled with the fact that when I got out of college, it was during the Vietnam era, and it was impossible to get into a good graduate school unless you had a grade point average about 1,000 points higher than mine. So, that coupled with the idea that I'd been fascinated by cooking and baking for my entire life up to that point, I decided, well, I think I'm going to go to culinary school instead of going to graduate school.
Well, now let's ask Mitchell the same question. Mitchell, we talked to you about your history with the James Beard organization, but I don't think we ever figured out how you started to cook.
Well, I didn't realize this till just now that Nick and I have a similar entree into the world, because I used to sit at home as a little kid and watch cooking shows, although I was watching Julia Child.
Oh, well, I watched those too, but I wasn't a little baby at the time.
No, but a few years later, there I was. I remember pretending to be sick to stay home from school because they were on mostly during the day, but that just got me interested. And I also grew up in a family that where food was very important.
Right, your mother was a fabulous cook.
Yeah, she was a great cook, and you know, we are Jewish, and our religion was rearranging the holidays so that we could all have dinner at the same time. It was all about the food. It wasn't really about anything else that was important. That's how I came to it too.
I don't know how I got there, because my mother hated to cook, and the
food. Well, my mother never liked
the food.
To cook
food tasted like
it. She had grown up with having her mother cook.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Then when my grandmother got too old and too ill to cook, my mother just started cooking one day. day, and the uncanny thing about it was that everything she made tasted exactly like the same things that her mother had made. I think it's probably a unique phenomenon in the history of cooking.
Yeah, we did have a couple of people who were generation, they said we were generation skippers. So grandmother cooked, mother didn't cook. And then,
started cooking. My mother was never a baker, though. I mean, that skipped the generation. Yeah. Every time I would bake as a teenager, my mother would mutter under her breath, "I've been washing mixer bowls and baking pans for my mother for 40 years, and now I've got to start washing them for my son."
I've met two kinds of people. You either come to food because you were in a family where food was important, or you come to food because you were in a family where you couldn't eat anything. The food was terrible, and it was sort of self-defense. I think that's
right. Very famous food writer Ruth Reichel, I think, comes from that kind of a home, right?
Yeah. Well, could we?
That her mother kept the food around until it was putrefied before she served it.
Yeah, guys, could we just take a break now, and then we'll come back and talk some more?
Sure.
Great. We'll take a break.
The internet is crucial to your business. Everybody knows this, but did you know Nidhogg is the company you should call for internet service? Nidhogg, personal web page hosting for less. Business web page hosting, Nidhogg offers both Unix and NT server support. Nidhogg is the company you should call for dedicated internet access. Nidhogg offers DSL for high speed, low cost, always on access. DSL is great. It means no more dial-up. Oh, by the way, do you remember that thing called the telephone? Do you remember when people used phone lines to access the internet? Oh, I'm sorry, you still use dial-up? Well, Nidhogg does that too. Local access telephone numbers? Okay, I don't understand it all either, but I do know that I need it, and I know where to get it. Nidhogg, Nidhogg.com, 412-661-5917. That's 661-5917, or log on, Nidhogg.com. Internet the Nidhogg way.
Hi, friends. I'm Phil Marcus, the host of Real Estate 101, heard every Saturday here on The Edge, AM 1550. If you've been thinking about selling your house or buying a house, I'd like to speak with you. Choosing the right agent is one of the first and most important steps in the process of buying or selling real estate. It's critical that you choose an agent who has the knowledge and experience to not only find that perfect new home for you, but to also be able to guide you step by step through the often complicated real estate process. If you don't already have a realtor, may I offer my services? I've been a real estate agent in Pittsburgh for almost 30 years. I'm a life member of the Realtors Association, and I'm proud to say that I've earned both the GRI and the coveted CRS professional designations. Won't you call me at RE/MAX Heritage? The phone number is 412-241-4200, extension 154, or my email address is phil@philmarcus.com. That's 412-241-4200, extension 154, or phil@philmarcus.com. Let's talk.
Have you been jazzing around yet? It's Sundays from 10 to 12 here on 1550. Get a taste of the latest jazz albums, a concert and club calendar, birthdays, awards, obituaries, and more. Plus featured artist interviews. That's a lot of jazzing. Check it out for yourself. Sponsored in part by Martini's Route 885 Jefferson, Original Recipe Italian Cooking, and Spider Mondanelli's Pittsburgh Jazz Giants, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Jazzing around. Sundays 10 to 12 here on 1550 The Edge.
Jazzin' Around with David J. is next on The Edge, AM 1550.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, with Mitchell Davis, whose book we were talking about, Kitchen Sense, and Nick Melgieri, whose book, Perfect Light Desserts, we're talking about. And we have so many more things to talk about. We just learned that on the break that Mitchell Davis went to the big Terra Madre event. Is that with Slow Food September?
October. In Turin.
Nick, you were talking about too?
Yeah, give us a report on it. What was it like?
Yeah, I actually didn't go to this one. I went to the one in 98.
And
that was quite wonderful. Well, I remember I spent a lot of time in the tasting rooms. And the other thing that was a really great influence on me from that visit was tasting a wonderful focaccia that had lard in the dough. And some baker from somewhere in Liguria was making this. And, you know, it's really convenient even if somebody doesn't want to give you the recipe in Italy, you know, if they're selling food publicly, they have to state what the ingredients are in the order of concentration, just like with packaged food here. So I wrote it down and made a couple of experiments, and so now I have my own recipe for it.
And what is
I mean, that's the great thing about the slow food meetings is they bring people together. It's like a crash course in Italian, well, in world gastronomy. So you walk through these halls where they just have representatives of all these products of everything from all over Italy, but also from Europe, and because of the Terra Madre this time, from all over the world. And it's nice to be in a giant convention hall with like-minded folks from all walks of life who believe that wholesome food and sort of sustainable and wholesome agriculture aren't just about eating a good meal, but are actually really noble pursuits that that we all ought to aspire to pursue. It was a great experience.
Now, do you think we'll get there? Do you think we'll get there, though, Mitchell? I mean,
it's complicated. I don't know. I mean, we were just talking at the break how I think that cooking is one way to help, I think, reconnect people to food, which is a reconnection to the land. And I know that sounds cliche and sort of crunchy feel granola, but I don't mean it that way. But I think that Slow Food's current campaign, that eating is an agricultural act, is a really important thing to remember.
That it's a political act, too.
It's a political, it's an agricultural, it's an everything act. Yeah. I mean, I'm studying food studies. That's what it's about. It's about these connections, and we've lost a lot of those connections. I think cooking is a really easy way, cooking and baking and all of that is a really easy way to reconnect. And look what's going on now between Taco Bell and Olive Garden. Those are, I think, ultimately the result of people losing any connection to their food and where it's from and what it is that they're actually doing. They're actually putting things in their bodies that are, you know, you would like to care more about rather than just have a 50-cent gordita or whatever.
Yes.
Don't you think also that food is a social act as well, and that's the piece of it that the United States has lost more than anywhere else? In other words, it's a family act. It's the kind of the kind of thing that holds families together. It's the kind of thing that allows friends to celebrate together. And when and when you lose that,
Do you remember your friend Brown visits the Japanese village every year?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, he said, this is a friend of ours who's an anthropologist, and he's been traveling to the same village in Japan for something like 45 years,
and documenting the changes.
Yeah, and he says that the transformation there is also really quite dramatic. And the funny part about it is that some of the biggest family social occasions are when the family all gets together and they go to McDonald's together. go figure.
Well, Japan's the second largest market in the world for McDonald's, I just learned this weekend.
Really?
After the United States.
Uh-huh, that's interesting. 4,000
units. But he views it, actually, this anthropologist, as actually a benefit.
Yeah, it's a positive
for the culture.
It's a positive social phenomenon because it's a special occasion.
Keeps them together, right?
Yeah, when the family gets together as a family unit. Most households in the United States don't get together as a family unit at least one meal a day.
No, but ironically, we're now celebrating family occasions in sushi bars. So there, go figure.
Oh, we are. Okay, I didn't know that.
I didn't know we were. Here we are.
Well, I don't know. They're very popular.
Right.
Well, you know, I think in every generation, there have been people who did a lot of home cooking and people who didn't. I don't think this particular generation is exceptional for the fact that people do or people don't cook at home. Mm-hmm. But it's true that when convenience foods started to become really widely available in the 1950s,
yeah, I was going to say
a lot of people stopped using fresher foods and
Swanson's frozen dinners, right?
Even the frozen vegetables and things.
Bird's eye, yeah.
I was just reading a new book by a very exalted British food authority.
Who's that?
About a bunch of different kinds of Middle Eastern cooking. And I was astounded to see that the first recommendation for the spinach pie was pre-washed baby spinach. The second choice was, real spinach with stems on it that you have to wash and take off. And the third choice was frozen spinach.
I've seen that a lot, actually.
Yeah, so I don't know. Frozen spinach, but the only time I ever tried to use frozen spinach when I used to teach a souffle class on a regular basis, I was astounded to find out that frozen spinach can be gritty.
Oh, no, I never heard that. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least the batch I got was. Maybe God was punishing me for using frozen spinach.
That's probably it, Nick. That's probably it. Mitchell, when you complete your doctorate, does that mean you're going to teach food studies?
I hope that'll be part of what I do. I don't see myself being an academic, you know, full time. But I do teach some things now for NYU and for other departments. But for me, it was really a way to force myself to read all these wonderful books that have been written about food and throughout history. And I need a deadline, and so that's helped.
I see. What are some of the landmark books that in your field?
In my particular, well, for restaurants, we happen to be in a time when all these great books are coming out, and I'm sure you know that because I'm sure you've had a lot of these authors
sometimes
on.
Sometimes five a day arrive.
Excuse me?
Sometimes I get five a day. I don't know who reads all these books.
But there are some great books about food. I mean, Sweetness and Power is always held up as one of the great initial books of food studies before there was an idea of it. It's a study of the sugar, the history of the sugar trade, both economic, political, and social, done by eminent anthropologist Sidney Mintz, who spent 20 years doing field work in the Caribbean. And that's sort of the kind of book that everyone wants to grow up one day to write.
Oh, yeah, right. I haven't seen this, what's his name's book on the oyster? Is that any good?
I haven't read it.
The History of the New York City. Yeah, I heard good things, too. I haven't read that yet.
Well, we're getting ready to read Michael Pollan next, I think, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm going to try to do that. The Omnivore's Dilemma, did you read that?
In fact, he was one of the keynote speakers at the Sierra Madre conference.
He's so stressed out with all this. He didn't really expect to get this kind of everybody wants a piece of him sort of thing. So.
Well, I want a piece of one of Nick's light desserts is what I want a piece of.
Thank you, Mitchell.
Well, you find out what he just baked, I think, Mitchell, and invite yourself around. That sounds like
sounds like
the right approach to me. I mean,
this doesn't look light. This thing.
Oh,
on
yeah,
the back
we got
cover.
We got the chocolate on the back cover here. Tell us the secret of that one. How is that
well,
low calorie?
Well, you know that really is easy to make. What I did with that recipe is, first of all, I decided to use some high cocoa solid content bittersweet chocolate.
Okay.
So you know that's certainly going to give you a good chocolate punch. And then with the remainder of the recipe, instead of using a lot of whipped cream for lightness and to give the mousse its texture, I decided to use a cooked meringue.
Oh, so that'll
that,
cut.
You know, we still have the lightness there. However, it's not going to be as caloric as using the whipped cream.
No.
But a mousse like that, of course, has to have some kind of a really good dairy flavor. So in order to provide that, I made a very simple cooked custard cream. And I used fat-free milk and a couple of whole eggs. And I'm really happy with the results on that one. That mousse is flavorful and has a wonderful texture. Again, is not the kind of a thing that tastes at all like a dessert that has had anything amputated from it in order to be light.
I love this man. I'm just reading one of his recipes. The book just happened to fall open at strawberries with balsamic vinegar and tarragon.
Right.
And it says use any balsamic that wasn't actually made in Modena. We have some 40-year-old left from when we went to Emilia Romagna in 1999, and we use it only in desserts. But this is the sentence that I like. The process used to make balsamic vinegar will always yield a dark brown product, so white balsamic vinegar is as impossible and nonsensical as white beef or white cocoa powder.
Wow.
somebody who can write that kind of sentence.
That's kind of, well, you know where the white balsamic vinegar came from? The last chef that Oprah had, the young woman who did a book and sold a lot of copies only because Oprah's name was on the cover, used white balsamic vinegar in a recipe.
There you go.
And I remember hearing somebody from the Italian Trade Commission saying that the Consorzio people, the union of people who make the real thing in Modena, were going crazy to try to figure out who was making this stuff in order to put a stop to it.
Crazy.
Yeah, I can understand that.
And I mean, it's the height of lunacy, and I have to say I own a bottle because a well-meaning but misguided friend once gave it to me as a gift, and it's sitting in my cupboard along with a lot of other ingredients that I use on a regular basis, and every once in a while I just look at it and shake my head when I open the cupboard.
You haven't flushed it down the toilet yet. That's probably where it belongs.
Well, guys,
you have a minute to wrap up here. Would you like to give a final plug for your book, Mitch?
I'd like to give a plug for all the good books written by people who believe that you don't have to be a scientist or a professional chef to make good things at home. And I think Nick and I and a bunch of our friends fall into that category. So Kitchen Sense, it's one of a type of book, I think, that will really make you happy to be in the kitchen.
That's great. Is it on our website?
Not yet.
It'll be on our website. So, and is Nick's book on our website?
No, didn't put either one of my. I don't think you told me to yet.
Okay,
then they go on
the website.
I only do it when somebody tells me to.
All right. Well, we need both of those on. And Nick, do you want to say one final thing for yours?
Sure. Well, light desserts don't have to be something that you feel like you're eating because you're being punished. You know, a light dessert can be every bit as flavorful and satisfying as one that has five times the amount of calories in it. And Perfect Light Desserts, my book, is filled with a